Hello, this is Scott Bessenecker, and you are listening to Voices from the Center. This is episode 3 of the podcast. I interview on this episode a young man named Cortland. Cortland's a Native American from one of the Lakota tribes who grew up on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. Interestingly enough, Bob Barker of Price is Right fame grew up on that reservation, not as a Lakota or a Sioux. His mom was a teacher there. But more importantly, a guy named Richard Twiss grew up on the Rosebud Reservation. Richard is author of a book called One Church, Many Tribes. Sadly, he passed away while he was still fairly young. He was just about 59 or so. And he was in process with a book that his wife has helped complete. It's going to be launched in July of 2015, called Rescuing the Gospel from the Cowboys. Richard's an interesting guy, and this reservation has an interesting history, and Cortland talks a little bit about his life on the reservation, just a variety of things coming from a Native perspective. I just love listening to him. I love his view on life. I like to think that I'm Native American. My grandma talked about a great-grandmother who was a Cherokee princess, or maybe that's just lore, but I love to think that I've got some kind of Native connection or Native blood. I'm probably about as Native as Taco Bell is Mexican, but there's something about the Native perspective on life that really resonates with me. Now, I interviewed Cortland outside. We're at this InterVarsity event, so Cortland works with Native students, and we were outside, and there are a number of noises that I'm going to ask you to press through. Maybe even just incorporate those into feeling like you're outside with us. So there's wind noise, and there's a fountain noise, and Cortland and I are enjoying a pipe. So if it sounds like Cortland has something in his mouth, it's a pipe. I want you to think of all of those things, not as distractions, but just as part of the interview so you can enter in with that spirit. Cortland is a philosopher at heart and a student of history. This comes out in the interview, as well as, you know, talking about pipes and wind and water noise and that sort of thing. But he talks at first here about being something of a forgotten minority in America and what it's like to be unseen. Talk a little bit about the invisibility of Native people in the U.S. and what that's like.
Well, the strangest thing about, I think, Indians in the U.S. is that, especially myself, is that when I'm back east, nobody has any understanding of, like, you know, some of these, like, terms that you're, like, life or death or all that. You know, there's a kind of a general idea. But it's weird just because it's like, you know, people just across the Mississippi have no inkling, you know, just because they haven't been around Natives. I mean, for me, being around Natives my whole life, it's like, these things we all know what we're talking about. But I've always been warned, it's like, back east, my friends would basically say, hey, back east is where all the white people ask the stupid questions. Like, you know, do you still live in teepees? Yes, that question still exists. I mean, it sounds like ridiculous, but it's true. You know, people just don't know any better. So it's like, I have to say, I mean, it's kind of difficult, like, living with that, but it's also, like, I have to say, it's kind of sad because it's, like, we need, you know, like, there has to be acknowledgement that there was someone who lived on this land before, someone who deeply loved it, deeply cared about it. Not saying that, you know, some of the farmers or settlers, like, you know, love the land as well. You know, that's good, but the fact is that there was someone who deeply loved the land, that this land has a story, that there were stories told here centuries before, and that, you know, I mean, sadly, it's like, you almost, like, you know, you're so, almost a lament for, as Tolkien probably would have put it, like, the loss of magic. Seems like, not magic as in, you know, the religious sense, or, you know, witchcraft, or anything like that, but a sense of wonder about, you know, that each tree had a story, or along those lines. Man, there are people who lived, suffered, you know, lived, had triumphs, died, moved, all that in this land, this very land, you know, I'm referring to right now. And it was so sad because me and my friend were talking, and we said, you know, the funny thing is nobody knows who lived here. We actually don't. We didn't have the name of the tribe who lived here beforehand, who called it home. And we think it might have been the Seminole, but then they're all in Oklahoma now. So it's like, how sad, how sad. And I feel like in India, it's like, you know, is that, it's kind of like, you know, it's weird. Because, like, indifference is taken to a whole new level when they forget that you exist. I mean, how odd is that? It's like, you know, I mean, I don't think there's any other ethnicity in the country that, you know, people forget that they exist. Like, not necessarily African-Americans, not Latinos, you know, even other immigrant Asian populations, you know, anyone else who's come, like, says, yeah, we know they're there, you know, they've been imprisoned, all that, but it's like, all of our struggles happened in the previous century, the 19th century, and it's like, for a lot of people, that's ancient history. You know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, is like ancient history. I mean, in the American context, you know, like, for Europeans, I'm sure it's like as far back as Charlemagne. But for us, it's like, we're still here, it's like, I'm only one generation removed from, the genocide, you know, the boarding school program and all that. I'm only one generation removed from that, technically two, removed from that. And, you know, most people just don't know that. It's like, it's strange to think that. It's kind of like a strange form of, like, it's almost like purgatory, like that. It's like, or like under the sea. Like, you know, we know that there's a wreckage. We know that there's been a fall in humanity. We know that. Natives probably for sure know that this is not the way things are supposed to be. But it's also weird because, like, there's a lot of people, you know, at whoever you want to, are very interested in making sure that we believe that this is just the way it's supposed to be. That, you know, oh, it's, the Indians are going to go away eventually. Eventually. They said that a century ago. We're still here. So I guess that shows the resilience of our grandparents. But also the fact of just that we're, you know, we are still here. And another deeply good friend of mine, his name's Mark Charles, I want to give him plenty of credit because he's the one who thought up the analogy. And he got it from his folks, too, and he said it's like a native in America. America's like a great grand house. You know, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's filled, you know, it's filled with natural beauty, wonders, not only resources, but rivers, you know, food. You know, it's infinite, infinite abundance, almost. Like, no other country, like, has what we have. I mean, land-wise. And it's like, slowly, like, this grandmother who owns the house has been pushed alone into, like, a small side closet. You know, and she's in there. She has her stuff. Like, they've given her, like, they've thrown all of, like, stuff they didn't throw away in there. And she's just in there, kind of sad, you know. There might not even be a window to the outside of the house. And that everyone's inside the house, enjoying the house, living in the house, struggling about who owns this room or this side of the house. But no one takes any point out, hey, there was someone who originally lived in this house. Hey, there was someone who loved this land, loved it, who lived here, who died here, who fought for it, fought for the future of it, who are just not present. And that's sad, but I think there's also hope as well as that, because the simple fact of the hope is we're still here. I'm still here.
Grandma hasn't died.
Yeah. Grandma, you know, her spirit, you know, even if she has, it's in me now. And, you know, these stories have been passed down, and they're going to continue to pass down. There is a, you know, great series of documentary, The We Shall Remain, and powerful PBS documentary. If you're, I'd say, you know, if you live, you know, on the East Coast and don't know anything about Indians, I'd say watch that five-part documentary. And it talks about, and the line actually comes from Tecumseh, and beautiful, beautiful reenactment with beautiful, beautiful music. You know, I mean, it's almost like a cinematic production. You can't believe how good some of these documentaries are. And he talks about, it's like, you know, the great, you know, the master of life, as the Shawnee put it, the master of life, that's who God is. The master of life. You know, everything, see, the master of it has appointed this place, referring to America, for us, the natives, you know, to light our fires. And here we shall remain. That's like, immensely hopeful here. It's like, even whatever might happen, we're not moving. We're going to stay here.
One of the things that I've studied is some of the social issues that arise out of a gap between rich and poor. And so it's not so much the reality of poverty or the reality of wealth, the existence of poverty, the existence of wealth. It's the coexistence of those things that create all these tensions. On Rosebud, on the reservation, there was no gap between rich and poor. Talk a little bit about the inclusion of poverty as a something that everyone experienced, and kind of the reality of growing up in a single class.
You know, I have to say, it's the strangest thing on earth, because it really changes your viewpoint on the world. You know, is that, I mean, most middle class folks, or most of your government, like, the assumption of rich and poor is like, you know, we have a house. The poor people may also have a house, but they don't have as much nice stuff as we do, and then the rich people have nicer stuff than we do. Now, where I'm from, it's mostly about, is that everyone's kind of on the same base level of poverty, but in reality, it's like, and the thing is, like, from my level of, I guess, you know, growing up in poverty, well, it's just weird, because I think I had to say my probably basis of what's poor is a lot lower than most folks, because, well, we had a house, we had enough to eat. We knew plenty of people who didn't have enough to eat, who actually had to survive on prairie turnips and, you know, gathering and actually stuff like that, because they were just so out of luck. You know, just so having such a difficult time.
They foraged for...
Exactly. It's crazy that they actually, that in this day, but there's a story about that. Well, either way, the prairie turnip, long story short, is that the prairie turnips promised to always feed the people. And the funny thing is that it's still feeding the people to this day. So we always have an emergency. You know, it saved us from famine then. There's a lot of Lakota stories about famine, actually, about not having enough to eat. And actually, that's something my grandma always feared. She always asked me, like, was I getting enough to eat? And I think the reason why is, there's an example of just, of, like, how the poverty, you know, has just come part of our cultural norms, is that a lot of Indian tribes have a lot of coffee. You'll notice, if you ever meet most Native folks, they'll drink a lot of coffee. Now, a lot of times now, it's, you know, they legitimately enjoy the coffee, they have their favorite Starbucks blend, and, or they like Folgers. A friend of mine from Alaska loves Hills Brothers. She swears by Hills Brothers coffee. And I'm not very much of a coffee, I'm a tea drinker myself, but my dad was telling me about how when his dad was growing up, you always got coffee in your ration allotments. And the reason why they drank it a lot is because he was the oldest son. But he had to take care of a lot of the other kids, you know, because the parents were toiling or, you know, drunk or who knows what they might have been up to. And he took care of them, but there was never enough food. So what the thing is about coffee, it's also a hunger suppressant. So he would always drink a lot of coffee to suppress his hunger so that everyone else would have enough to eat. So it's like, there's a lot of stories of, like, you know, that's weird how that's something that was a practical thing that people, the Indians, realized, wait, you know, this black drink, this, you know, the Lakota call it Kalapi, you know, it suppresses hunger, but it's also pretty good, too. So it's something that started off with a very sad story, but became, I have to say, probably a bit more uplifting. Just because, you know, who would ever think that, you know, I mean, the food situation was really, really bad. They actually did caloric studies on Indian rations from, like, 1890, which is the low point of all natives in America. There were 500,000 Native Americans, I believe, in the Western Hemisphere at 1890, right after Wounded Knee. That was after disease, you know, war, all that took its toll. They really thought we were going to disappear. They really did. Which, after looking at those numbers, I'm not surprised. But they looked at the studies, and they found out that the government actually, they probably didn't think at the time, but they weren't giving us enough to survive on, is that the calories were, like, I think, like 800 calories a day. 800 calories a day, which, you know, for Siberian prisoners, like, you know, I mean, like, you need, like, at least 1,100 for base bodily function. So a lot of times, a lot of people, like, as I said, would dig turnips, all that, and, you know, nobody starved, but there was definitely that fear of famine in mind. So I would tend to think of rich and poor this along the line of your original question of having enough to eat. So I would not say growing up as a rich kid. I mean, I would say I was almost like growing up a rich kid because I always had enough to eat. I always did. But I also knew that there are people who didn't. And it's strange to think that is that it always it reminds me of moral insanity when there's people who are eating too much and then there are people who aren't eating at all. But it also, it fills you with a strange feeling when the people who aren't eating enough are so grateful for what they do have. A lot of times they'll be grateful, like, oh gosh, like we're having the sandwich, you know, or we have enough for bologna, you know, this week, or we have enough for ramen noodles, you know. It's like we're rich this week. While, you know, you have people in high-star restaurants, you know, complaining about the quality of their steak. And
well, you moved off the reservation in eighth grade, moved into Billings, Montana, and experienced a different kind of poverty, the poverty of exclusion. Talk a little bit about that that tension of being in a very inclusive but poor community to being in a wealthier community but with a lot of exclusion.
You know, I had to say it was quite a big change. And I haven't really given it too much thought until, I guess, you know, these last few years with my work and all that, but looking back on Billings and my time there, and nothing against Billings, nothing against that, but Billings is like a lot of Western cities where there's a lot of suffering and a lot of, you know, natives just aren't. It's more of it's exclusion at its best and antipathy at its worst. Like I don't say there's not really too many hate crimes, thank God, but we always heard plenty of stories about people being dragged behind the ends of trucks, stuff like that, horrible stuff, you know, barbaric, savage stuff. You know, there was always rumors of stuff like that. But
those savage white folk.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. It's kind of like they call us the savages. I think that's an example where, you know, someone has a sense of humor somewhere. But, you know, I mean, it was strange because it was like, it's weird. It's kind of like you're there, but you're also not there. Like, you know, I'm myself. But I'm just thought of kind of as another, I guess, unit in this city. So there was ultimately, I guess, maybe even, like, the exclusion that just comes to city life. But also, like, we didn't really have much of a big social circle, so I didn't really see that much. I don't remember having a lot of friends at all during the Billings time when I was there, like, for a few years. Is that it was mostly, you know, just me. And I'd say some of the other times where something came from outside in was almost like an invasive force. Like, I remember I was walking down the street by the mall one day. You know, there's a bus transfer station at the end of the mall, and I rode the bus a lot, which is kind of like just for something to do. And that's actually where I started reading, so it wasn't all bad, but I have to say it's like, you know, it was just like that exclusion. Like, you know, it's kind of like it's me, myself, here, and this giant world. This giant indifferent, but also indifferent world, I think it was the first impression. But then it also comes to this world that's filled with antagonism and antipathy. Of, like, I remember there was some guy, you know, some, you know, people, they were driving by in a car, and, like, they threw a beer can at me, and they just yelled, "Hey, Indian, white power!" And they did the Nazi salute type of thing like that. And the funny thing is, like, I didn't really think too much about it at the time, but I still remember it. Like, I still remember what the day was like. I remember what I was wearing. I remember, you know, where I was walking. The same specific street. I know exactly probably what proximity of the street, but it was very, very strange of just like saying like that there's someone in here, in this city, in this place, or perhaps even the whole world, who sees me, knows what I am, you know, the base, you know, ethnicity, and does not want me around. Like, it doesn't even want to engage in any type of getting to know me or anything of the sort. So it's like, and I have to say, even today, I'm probably still very, not to say comfortable in cities. Like, my grandma, she was always very uncomfortable in cities or where there's a lot of white people. And we always kind of talked about it as a family. But my mom once took her to Crow Agency, which is a Crow reservation, about 60 miles from Billings. And that's where we went to go get IHS services and all that. Always kind of a pain because it was so far away. But I remember, like, my grandma completely changed when she got on even this foreign reservation. She completely changed. She was in her normal, talkative, blunt, funny self. But in the city, she wasn't. She always kept her eyes downcast. you know, and she always kind of encouraged us to do the same. It's like, don't bother the white people, or don't, you know, don't get in their way. Don't get in their way is probably the best way to put it. But I kind of realized, after living in Billings, is that there's, I have to say my vision of poverty really changed, is that there's people who are happy, and there's people who are sad. And I'd have to say, is like in the cities, I've just seen a lot of sad people. A lot of sad, lonely people, too. And one thing my mom always encouraged me, she was really, you know, she was someone who was very smart, very educated, but she kind of knew a lot of things, especially about being present. And I'd have to say she was probably a practical Christian, like she believed in Jesus, all that, but she kept a lot of the traditional ways as well. But she always told me, like, that's what makes a difference. Anyway, she told me, it's like, Corlin, never be one of these people who, like, always have their headphones in their ears. And I said, why? It's like, they don't want to see the world. They don't want the world to engage with them. They don't care for the world enough to even give it an attention. You know, we're sitting out here right now. I'm enjoying the sound of the fountain out there. You know, pretty foreign, you know, kind of like, you know, I think it's kind of ridiculously extravagant. For a hotel,
yeah,
I mean.
A water feature for our auditory enjoyment.
Exactly. You know, for people, like, getting in and out of their cars. Just for that, you know. I mean, I'm wondering how many people have just enjoyed it. I really like it. I enjoy it. It's, you know, it's not only, like, a novelty, but it's something I genuinely enjoy. It's, like, a beautiful thing. Like, someone put a lot of artistic craftsmanship in that. And these trees, too. I mean, you know, palm trees are palm trees, but I love to hear out here sitting to the wind and listening to it and all that. And that was, I think that was something she was encouraging me to do. And in some way, it was like, in some way, I think in a really roundabout way, she was telling me to remember my heritage of being really, really present, listening to what the trees have to say. Is that we always say, is like when you take a walk, the wind's very sacred in the Lakota religion as being, you know, a sign. Especially western wind. I think this wind actually might be coming from the west. But I loved hearing the sound through the trees, even these different trees. I mean, it reminds me of, like, connection to God, the Almighty. Like, even in the small moment, yeah. The small moment sitting here, I'm enjoying it. But if I'm listening to, granted, the music's good. I'm not saying that. I listen to my MP3 player on the airplane the whole way. But then there's really nothing to take. There's really nothing to hold the airplane. But it's like, there's a sense of wonder that most natives have, and that were taught, and it seems like a lot of the forces of acculturation, assimilation, were eliminating those wonders, or just to kind of get us to think in the way of boxes and squares.
Yeah.
I'd say that was kind of the thought. So I had to say is that for most poverty in America, it's people who would be much happier in the country. They'd be much happier. I mean, they'd probably still maybe not have the same amount of money. You know, there's flight from the rural areas. But at least maybe in the rural areas, people would have a chance to be, you know, happier. I mean, you know, just have, like, a circle of friends, all that. Or you have a choice to either be lonely in the city or poor in the country. I think I would tend to prefer to be poor in the country.
I like that about the pipe, because I feel like the pipe slows me down. Like, you're always putzing with it. You can't be on your computer and smoke a pipe very easily.
Oh, exactly.
And so there's this sort of forced slowing down. You got to relight. You got to pack it. And there is something spiritual, if I may, about smoking a pipe.
I would agree. You know, is that like Tolkien and Lewis, who are, I would say, probably both medieval men in their outlook, but who are kind of, I guess, wizards in the sense of, like, defending us, you know. I would say I really loved Lord of the Rings, and it always appealed, like, most of my native friends hate white culture, but they love Lord of the Rings. And I say, yes, it's the best part of probably of Anglo culture, is like, because that's really where Anglo ethics come from. It's like the medieval era. I mean, that sounds kind of strange, because, you know, I mean, well, witch burnings and all that, and, you know, but still there is, like, there's something honorable in chivalry. These stories, these, like, the time when we actually cared for stories. I think that's what Tolkien, like, the reason I brought most of the pipe is that they both loved drinking beer, sitting on a pipe, and being in fellowship with, you know, the inklings and all that. Honestly, that's what kind of inspiration for me as an artist. But also, it's like, you know, these people, you know, were from completely different cultures. They have no idea what I do, but they love stories. And I love stories, too. And I think all natives love stories. I think that's what really marks, like, someone, I mean, for me, is, like, do you like stories or you don't? And I think most people always do. Like, you know, tell me this story. And I think that's why I kind of share this weird kinship with these, you know, people who love the old historical ballads, or I like the traditional stories as well. It's like, tell me that story. I want to hear that story. And I like telling stories as well. And I think the pipe's the perfect example of, like, opposed to cigarettes, you know, it's just like, you know, like, cigarettes, a total example of, I think, something that was supposed to be good, tobacco, you know, to kind of an indulgence every now and again. But now it becomes like an addiction because it's been pre-rolled up for you, and it's like, it's sold in packets for you, and it has all that. It's like, it's like we get closer to hell when we add convenience and speed together, and it just ultimately, you can come up with like these things that are supposed to be very, very enjoyable. And I was always amazed because I'm at our college, you know, they have designated smokers everywhere now. And I was amazed, like, I saw like 18 people in a group, 18 people. They were all smoking, but none of them were talking to each other. And it was cold, they were all miserable, and they were all smoking. I was like, that's hilarious, but that's also, like, really sad, because it's like, gosh, what a chance to actually, you know, even though I don't think, you know, smoking cigarettes is not the best way to do it, I obviously say pipe, but it's like, you know, what a chance to actually just get to know someone, to invest in one person for a moment. Like, just to give yourself to that moment. Or opposed to just, oh, I'm just standing here, I'm getting my nicotine fix, all that. It becomes very, very scientific and very, not to say evil, I'm not saying science is evil, but it's like there's this robotic thinking that's taken over. Like thinking, okay, I'm designating time to cigarette smoke, I'm designating time to this, we've all become slaves to the clock. But I think the thing about all the authors that I enjoy so much are advocates of turning the clock back. And I know that sounds impossible, but what's the point of a clock if you can't turn it back or turn it forward, whatever you might need to do? I think the clock's actually a really good way to measure time, is because, oh, you can move it back, or you can move it forward, or, you know, you can tweak with it however you want. That's not really how we judge time. Time's more about what you do. And, like, I'm always a fan of, like, I'll just have conversations with people, you know, random people, till the morning comes, or the afternoon, or just, I can just patter a whole afternoon away just chatting to someone about all running across the gamut.
You hear something of Cortland's philosophy or love of philosophy and his reflections on time and a little bit of a stream of consciousness as he talks about medieval thought and reality and fantasy and a variety of things. But he's also something of a theologian, working for university now as a Christian minister on campus. And he reflects a little bit on the encounter that Native people had with the gospel and his own journey and his dabbling in deism before entering into a true conviction about Christianity. I just loved hearing some of his thought about life and faith on the reservation.
So you had to say when the Calvinists, you know, Calvinistic Christians, talk about a very grim version of the gospel. A friend of ours, another friend of mine, basically, we were talking about who came to, like, some tribes first, and we said the Calvinists, they said, oh, you know, that's a scary, scary gospel. And my joke to that, yep, Jesus is coming, and he is pissed. But I think, like, the people, the folks who really made the most difference were primarily the Roman Catholic Church. Like, in Rosebud, like, well, what happened was on the tribes, there was, like, every tribe was kind of, like, divvied up among the religious denominations to different groups. So, actually, like, the Navajos, for example, the Christian Reformed Church, which I believe comes out of the Dutch tradition, actually got the Navajo Reservation. So there's a lot of Christian Reformed churches on the Navajo Reservation. However, on my church, it was around the Roman Catholics. So, like, there's a town called St. Francis in Rosebud, which I thought was very forward-thinking of them at the time, because, you know, St. Francis, Indians, I think whoever was the priest in charge, did a pretty good job, because I know a lot of folks who are Catholic, and a lot of the great Lakota chiefs became Catholic, but also still believed in, like, the old ways. Like, Sitting Bull, like, when there's a famous picture of Sitting Bull anywhere, he's wearing an English shirt, but it's a very famous picture, you've probably seen it online and all that, and he has the feather in his back, and this is after he surrendered, but you look down by his chest, he's wearing this very large crucifix on him. And it was just funny is that, you know, is that I think a lot of
this god, of this, you know, this savior who came and bled for all the people. I believe that's something that resonates highly, and that resonates with myself as the savior. A god who not only fasts, but a god who also feasts. You know, that's a very interesting it gets rid of the whole, overtly spiritual, rejection of the body.
Gnostic.
Exactly, Gnostic rejection of the body. It's like all the codos think, oh, that man's ridiculous. It's like, uh-huh. Like you're eating, it's real. It's or then the total, or also rejection, I'd have to say, of Calvinist theology, of very rigid, very stern. Oh, it's almost like Christian materialism, Calvinism, you know, with predestination, but the Lakota stories, especially the old ones, what do I say? You know, there's always a choice. There's always a choice the man in the story can make to change his life or to seek whatever he loves or in order of that. And all those stories meant a lot to me, and ultimately what led me to Christ was really a rediscovering not only of my traditional stories, but also the Christian story itself. And I'd have to say, yeah, I kind of went through, in my teenage years, after we moved from the reservation, I went through kind of a wilderness stage of, I called myself a deist for a while, you know, from the 17th and 18th century tradition, you know. And I always like to explain is basically God, you know, God is here, God loves you, God cares, but he's not doing anything about it.
He's asleep
at the wheel or something along the sorts like that. And it's like, that's always, I kind of liked it because I kind of didn't see much of God in my life. So it's like, all these theological concepts which I believe, tenuously at the time, still are true. But it's also true that it was also okay that I didn't believe in them. That was definitely my thoughts behind it, was that it's okay if I don't believe because God's not doing anything, but he's still there, so I still can believe it in some tenuous way. So I kind of went through a very lukewarm period.
Finally, Cortland talked about growing up on the reservation and something of the odd artificiality of the Western buildings on the reservation, as well as the fact that there were no materialists. There's a lack of spiritual apathy on the reservation. Everyone was spiritually engaged. And it reflects a little bit on his mother, his appreciation for his lovely, endearing, but imperfect mom.
I mean, I have to say it was a pretty good childhood. I mean, I've known a lot of people who've had worse, much worse, as a matter of fact, you know, some of my own relatives, and I have to say that I was blessed. I was just blessed, you know, having such a wonderful mother, you know, that I had at the time, who was so eager to raise me, you know, there, but also, you know, to do her best to educate me as best as she could and to protect me from the worst effects, I'd have to say, of the poverty and, you know, the despair and, you know, the bad, I'd say, the medieval thinkers would have called it, like, bad humors, which almost you'd consider that, it's almost applicable in that way. It seems that there's almost something in the air sometimes. And, but I have to say, though, I mean, I remember a lot of, growing up there, it's like, you know, it's flat, but yeah, I also remember having a lot of inklings of a lot of, like, traditional stories as well. And, I mean, I think that's why magical realism as a genre, I mean, I don't particularly like magical realistic novels. I'm sure you've probably read a few, like, Bless Me Ultima, that are very, like, I kind of deal with the similar thing in New Mexico, ethnic experience and childhood in difficult places that adults typically would not tend to think about. But for mine, I'd have to say, growing up there and going to a Christian school like I did, I definitely, there was always a belief in the supernatural. That growing up, there was always stories of buildings that were filled with ghosts, and no one ever like there was no materialists on my reservation. I don't remember a single materialist.
Material on your reservation.
I said not too much material, not too much material, and no materialism. You know, one of my favorite things is just that they talk so much about, I guess you know, the whole effort of colonization and conquest. It all looks so artificial because all the buildings don't look like they're supposed to be there, especially in the tribal towns. Is that mostly there are these plastic and tin structures that are like the grass is ready to reclaim them at any time. But and it's always just interesting. It's like you get like the distinct feeling, at least from nature, that it's not necessarily supreme, but it's something that you must respect, and that these buildings that are kind of like flying into place, these squares and these plastics, are the ones that are like the most susceptible to all the. To the winds, the snows, and all that. I mean, I remember some bad winters, too, when I was a kid growing up there, too. So it's like, oh, you... I mean, it feels like the belief in a god or the gods, or as the Greeks or I would put it, is pretty... It's always when you get into uncomfortable places where the gods show up. Or we remember them. You know, I tried to think of, like... it's always in cities where you kind of see, like, spiritual... I guess, just... apathy.
Huh.
Like, it seems like spiritual apathy has to be something of the cities, or at least in what we probably see it in America today. But, back to the childhood, sorry. I have to say it was a good childhood, though in native, I have to say in native terms. In native terms. It's like, I went through pretty well compared to everybody else. Yeah, I was very blessed with a mother who deeply, deeply cared for me, but she was not without her problems either. You know, she had, she had troubles, you know, she drank, but never necessarily to excess, and she told me this story about, this is probably a good way to end that, yeah, is, she told me about how, some of her friends were, so she knew, like, when she was working at the college in there, she said, oh, you know, just, you know, go drinking with us, you know, because she was just explaining to them that she was, like, all kind of nervous and kind of down on a lot of things, and... Go drink. So, what should I do with my son? It's like, oh, just, you know, make sure to put plenty of food in the house and give him a lot of, like, videos to watch, and he'll be fine. Just, you know, just go there and don't, so basically don't come back during the night.
It was so enjoyable sitting outside, having a pipe, and just listening to Cortland talk. I loved how he thought about things and how he expressed things. And, yeah, there was just something about that time that helped me to appreciate the Christian faith as it gets expressed through the worldview of, in this case, the Lakota. A few weeks after that, in fact, just about a week ago, I was in Ireland and I was helping to lead some university students who were studying abroad there on a pilgrimage into Celtic spirituality, into the Celtic church, and it was so interesting. The Irish were some of the first people, I think, to so thoroughly absorb the Christian faith and dress it in Celtic clothing that they nearly divided from the Roman Church. It was so thoroughly Irish, so thoroughly Celtic in their way of understanding the gospel, in their way of living out the Christian faith. The circle in the Celtic cross, right around the cross beam, that was part of their expression of understanding the earth and the place that creation plays in our relationship with God and our relationship with the faith. The Irish, they were almost like the Native Americans of that part of Europe. The Celtic believers, very close to the earth, very much in touch with creation, and feeling it was very central to the gospel. Another Native friend who's also a scholar, theologian, and understands Greek and Hebrew, reads his Bible in Greek and Hebrew, and he says, you know, the great Protestant verse, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. He says, when I read that in the Greek, I read, for God so loves the cosmos, so loved the cosmos that he gave his son, that God's love includes all things, that it's a cosmic love. And I think the Celtic believers were very much in touch with that, and that expression of Christianity, I think, is really needed. I think we've dressed the gospel so thoroughly in not just Western clothing, but in Northern European Western clothing. That is, that our English and Swiss and German ancestors, Protestant ancestors, have really filtered the gospel through that Northern European specific cultural lens. And so it's refreshing to hear stories of Native peoples really getting a hold of the radioactive core of the gospel and having that expressed in their own reactor, in their own worldview. And I loved my time with Cortland and hearing him talk about life and faith and the gospel. Hope you enjoyed listening to Cortland as well, and we'll tune in next time for Voices from the Center.